Any questions to the last lecture? Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's not for the last lecture, but I'm still not very sure about the 3+1 decomposition, because it seems to me that we are choosing like a preferred time, and at the same time we are not considering any more time and space in the same frame.
What I have chosen is to indeed just say you do have to make a choice of coordinates, and particular time coordinates. And so I've also chosen to say if you have covariant coordinates, just choose them x0 as t. You can do it more complicated, but that doesn't change anything, because you could make it more complicated saying you choose an embedding of your hypersurface into your manifold, and that defines your constant time hypersurface. And then you have to deal with these embedding functions. But that doesn't change anything. And then the point of the analysis, if you would do it, is to indeed see that all the constraints, they do generate exactly the kind of diffeomorphisms which allow you to make an arbitrary choice of time. So just that in principle, you have to make a choice. But then later you learn the choice doesn't matter. The choice doesn't matter. Then there's also people which advertise a more covariant looking formalism, where you introduce momenta also for the spatial derivatives. Again, typically it makes things more complicated, but then you get either the same thing or you get even something more complicated. So here in 3D, we have seen we do get the translations and the rotations, and they give us together a diffeomorphism symmetry in its canonical form. And that allows you to make arbitrary choices of time. With respect to the time evolution, if you start with a hypersurface here, we have seen that you can choose arbitrary Lagrange multipliers, which we have written for the rotations and the translation things, constraints. But they will boil down to arbitrary Lagrange multipliers for your constraints which generate hypersurface deformation. And these are called Lebesgue shift. And so basically the gauge equivalence says, you know, this, if you have data here, choosing any kind of Lebesgue and shift tells you how this hypersurface is deformed if you apply a gauge transformation. You can also go backwards. And so from this hypersurface, you get the data on any other kind of hypersurface here. And the gauge equivalence tells you, indeed, you have to impose in quantum theory that all these things are equivalent. So there's really not really any explicit choice of space and time in the end of the analysis you do. So in general, we have considered one example, and I've given you a bit of the simplest case where you can kind of half guess what is going on. As I mentioned yesterday, not yesterday, but last lecture. So it's a system where we have constraints, and you can have, in this case, these constraints are first class, which means that the Poisson brackets commute. And so commute weakly. And so that means that on the right-hand side, you again have a constraint. And this can be, in principle, phase-based dependent, these structure constants, or if they're phase-based dependent, structure functions. So this commutation guarantees you that if you define your constraint hypersurface as a hypersurface where all the constraints vanish, the flow of such a constraint which gives you flow lines. Now, if you have a phase-based point P, then the flow will bring you to another point P prime here. Goes along the constraint hypersurface. It will not go off. So these things, since we define them, since the phase-based point we see as initial data, and the initial data on the constraint hypersurface are the things we can evolve. So in our case, this is indeed equal to time evolution. And for instance, Yang-Mills case, you would have a proper Hamiltonian, but the proper Hamiltonian would come with an additional term, which would be Lagrange multiplier with Gauss constraints. And so this would be the orbits of these Gauss constraints. And we said we should see points on this orbit to be physically equivalent. So if you have constraints, we have two things. And it's all first class constraint, because the second class constraint is where this is non-vanishing. These Poisson brackets are non-vanishing on the constraint hypersurface. So you have two effects. You need to constrain. Let me say, need to reduce to the constraint hypersurface. And B, we have a gauge symmetry. So gauge orbits along the hypersurface. And so if you have n constraints and your phase space is 2n dimensional, and we also assume that the constraints are independent, it can happen that they're actually kind of redundant, but let's assume they're independent. Then this constraint hypersurface is 2n minus capital N dimensional, because you have n conditions to set the function equal to 0. And your orbit, they are generated by n different constraints. So you have n parameters. And again, if they're independent, you get an n dimensional orbit. And so here we lose n dimensions. Here we say we have to take these n dimensional orbits and identify them as points. So in summary, you get actually, so here need to quotient out, go quotient by orbit. Or the gauge action. And the resulting space, sometimes it's called a reduced phase space, or a physical phase space, will be 2n minus 2n dimensions. So in our case, we have a field series. So it's we have a 6 times infinity dimensional phase space. And we have 3 times infinity constraints. So we get actually 0 dimensional. Now, if you in the case that you can conclude that infinity minus infinity is actually 0, but sometimes infinity minus infinity is not 0. So instead of getting something infinite dimensional, you get something finite dimensional, because there could be some degrees of freedom which are left over, and these degrees of freedom are topological. So now you could ask, why do we do this nonsense of having this huge phase space? And then we do the constraints, and then we do the gauge orbits. Why don't we start with the physical phase space at once and just care about the physical phase space? One answer is that actually in quantization, we are not very good how to quantize general systems. What you probably have learned is how to quantize Rn. Even if you try to quantize something like R plus, that's already quite subtle. But these constraint systems can be even worse. So if you have constraints, you know, that might give you complicated hypersurfaces. Typically, they will have several components. Then if you have gauge orbits, if you try to quotient them out, that can give you, that gives you an orbit space, which typically might not be everywhere of this dimension, but sometimes the gauge action has fixed points, so you would have conical singularities and so on. So it's usually it's not very obvious how to quantize a very complicated phase-space manifold. In field theory, typically the gauge covariant formalism, that argument was usually invented to have a local description in terms of local fields. Whereas if you go to try to express things in gauge invariant terms, these are non-local. So you don't see that so much in electrodynamics, but you see that much more in Young-Mills. And it's extremely non-local. I mean, people are still discussing what it means in general relativity. So the gauge invariant, the reduced phase space in general relativity is something which we can't yet parameterize. So it's hard to quantize. So that's why we go the more complicated route. So there's several remarks, I think. Okay, reduced or physical phase space. One way to deal with the constraints is to do a gauge fixing in this context of a canonical theory. This means you introduce gauge fixing functions, and you need to introduce as many gauge fixing functions as you have first class constraints. And they need to cut, ideally, they need to cut each orbit in exactly one point. And so that means that locally, the constraint flow has to change t, because otherwise, if it would be zero, it would be constraint hypersurface, which it would be gauge fixing hypersurface, which goes a bit parallel to the orbit, so that t equal to tau does not change. So you need to have this condition, and so you can ask, why don't we do that? And the problem is that in many situations, there is no such good global gauge fixing, starting with Young-Mills. and not to say general relativity. And again, the reason is that the constraint hypersurface and the gauge orbits can be very complicated. Even in the simple case that your gauge orbits are spheres, then typically you will, for instance, not know what to do with the North Pole or what to do at r equal to zero. So you get you can get subtle things. And well, spheres is even a very nice case you can you could have. Okay. Well, the next chapter in the script, which I won't deal with here, is indeed looking into more detail what is the exact combination of the constraints which gives you hypersurface deformation and calculating the hypersurface deformation algebra. So this uses a fact which is also kind of important. Namely, here we use explicit constraints, explicit phase space functions. But actually, you don't. The formalism doesn't need it so much. These explicit form of the constraints. You, if you have a constraint, you have a base, two constraints. You can take any kind of combination of these constraints with certain Lagrange multipliers. If you choose another basis of two constraints, and they're everywhere. You can express these two pairs of constraints with the other two pairs of constraints. You get the same constraint hypersurface. So what is actually important, the invariant information, is the constraint hypersurface. In GR, these differences between hypersurface deformation and the flatness and translation symmetry constraints is a bit more subtle because there are again points where actually this equivalence does not hold because your transformation leads to some coefficients where these coefficients are zero. So that holds for instance, degenerate matrix. And that's where, for instance, if you have matrix, we would use matrix formalism. You would, for instance, in principle, you would have to implement that your matrix has to be always positive and non-degenerate. If you have triads, you can have positive triads and negative triads. And so, for instance, the flow of the translation symmetry changes can change a positive triad with positive orientation into triad with negative orientation. But by doing so, it actually goes through a point where the determinant of the triad is zero, so it's degenerate. but in general, what is important is a constraint hypersurface. So the point is that in field theories, if you can have points of lower dimensions, which don't seem to be important, but in the end might be important in quantum theory, then you might still wonder how to define the gauge orbit if you don't have explicit constraints. It does happen that you know, you have a so-called symplectic structure or the Poisson brackets, which defines you the flow on the phase space. If you take this and this symplectic structure, at least in the finite dimensional phase space, is non-degenerate, which is a bit hard to express for phase space functions. But if you have heard of a symplectic structure, it means that if you put a tangent vector to your phase space, so the symplectic structure is an antisymmetric form in which you put tangent vectors in your phase space. So non-degenerate means that this as a one form is never vanishing. but if you constrain, if you pull back your symplectic structure, symplectic form on the constraint hypersurface, and you have first-class constraints, what will happen is that you get degenerate directions on your constraint hypersurface, and these degenerate directions are exactly your gauge orbits. And so here you see that already in the geometry, that's the reason why you have here a gauge fixing which cuts the orbits exactly, because it's these directions which you need to factor out, the degenerate directions for your symplectic structure, to get a proper phase space. In fact, you see here that you, in principle, you can get an odd number, but you want to get back to an even number with your reduction. Okay, so one last thing is to discuss is physical observables or Dirac observables. The same thing. Well, depending on who you speak with, but so on the kinematic phase space, we can have, in principle, we have arbitrary phase space functions, but they can have some non-trivial flow with respect to the constraints. And so that would mean that this phase space function gives us different answers on different points of the same gauge orbit. But we want to identify the gauge orbits to a point in our physical phase space. So what we need is that our physical observables are constant along the gauge orbits. And so what would be the condition that these observables need to satisfy? Yeah, it's the gauge orbits. The gauge orbits are generated by the constraints. The flow of the constraints gives you the gauge orbit. So this would tell you how an observable changes under the flow of the constraint. So we say that this needs to be constant, vanishing. The change needs to be vanishing. But again, it needs to be only vanishing on the constraint hypersurface. So that needs to be weakly vanishing on the constraint hypersurface. That's the condition of a Dirac observable. Okay. Any questions? F is an arbitrary phase space function. I just wanted to say an arbitrary phase space function is usually not constant along your gauge orbit. The trivial standard, yeah. So typically, it's not very easy to find explicit expressions for these observables. Again, the script is a bit indicated how you could compute observables, just as the computation description does not need to converge everywhere. So it might not give you a globally well-defined observable. But we will see that in an example. And so having this situation is, of course, a question, what do you do in quantum theory? How do you deal with the constraints and the fact that you have unphysical degrees of freedom? And so typically, you don't want to give any quantumness to your unphysical degrees of freedom. Mostly because we have seen that there is a reduced or physical phase space which doesn't even know about any gauge degree of freedom. So it would be, you never get anything equivalent if you don't take that into account with a reduced phase space quantization. And so discuss that. Well, in principle, that would be the next quantization of gauge systems. And well, we start with canonical quantization. In the end, I will also argue how to derive covariant quantization or path integral quantization from that. But since, I mean, I can write you the abstract conditions, which we will do in the end. To see what is going on, we will consider kind of the simplest example there is. Because it will teach us a lot of things and clarify issues which are sometimes a bit confusing in the literature. And that's a parameterized particle. And so we will also quantize it in various ways, and you see that everything is equivalent. So that's a nice example to discuss all kinds of things, as much as a parameterized particle allows you to discuss things. So what does it mean? It will have the parameterized particle will be equivalent in the end to the usual particle. You can put a potential or not. But you want to introduce a similar symmetry as in GR, which is, in particular, it includes arbitrary choice of time. So you want to include an arbitrary choice of time for the parameterized particle. And to do that, we will declare the time parameter, which we usually have, as a variable. So then we also know we need to add a symmetry to the action. And this symmetry will be so-called reparametrizations of your time. So that's just that time will be a coordinate choice. So usual action for a particle or any system, I mean, you can actually, it's not constrained to a particle. You can take any mechanical system where you have an explicit time parameter. Which, as we know, we usually describe with Lagrangian, which is first order and derivative. And for the particle, it's quadratic in the velocities, has some potential. So now we want to add TQ as or configuration, we want to add T as a variable. If I add T as a variable, I need another evolution parameter, which I will call S. So S has the same role as T usually has. And so then what we want to have is that having added a variable, we want to add a symmetry, a gauge symmetry. And this gauge symmetry, we want to have that a trajectory. You know, if I take that for a certain interval in S, it defines me a trajectory. In which is slightly hard to draw. So if that's Q, T, and S, the trajectory might look like this. Definitely a 3D picture. But what we want to have is that if you change your S parameter, but just along the trajectory in the same way for both entries, that this gives you an equivalent trajectory. So in this picture, it's 3D. So if you have a free particle, it will go like this. You know, the point is, if you choose S to go like that, that it's faster with respect to S, it will be a trajectory which has a bit more, goes more in this direction. But they all have the same, they will have the same projection onto the TQ plane. And you can make it also varying, just that I cannot draw it, sorry. So you could go a bit in this, then you go very fast, and you go almost parallel. So that would be, so if this equivalence holds, that would be so-called reparametrization invariance. Now, the action as it stands there is not reparametrization invariant because we don't even have an S parameter. But you can take any of these Lagrangians. You can even do it in field theory if you wanted to. And make your system reparametrization invariant, even under diffeomorphisms, if you have a field system, field theory. And so we had this S. So we can say S parametrized. We had the action there. What we do want to have is an action which gives us the same number for these two different trajectories, if they have the same initial and final points. The same number for equivalent trajectories, but on each of these trajectories, the number is given by this action. So you can actually write it in these terms. So q dot is actually the velocity with respect to t. So I introduce q prime is dq ds, and that's if you know what you want to have as invariant is q qt. So here you can always compute from that q as a function of t. If you invert t of s as s of t. So q prime is dq dt dt ds, which is q dot t prime. So there I have a Lagrangian q dot. So q dot is q prime divided by t prime. And then I need to integrate not with respect to t, but with respect to s. And t and s are not the same, but they are connected by a t prime. So this t prime is actually the same factor you see. It's like the determinant of square root of g. That would be the equivalent thing. So here you have t prime ds. So and by construction, this action is invariant under reparametrizations. It only sees q of t and not your particular choice of reparametrization S. Okay. Thank you. the beta 2 and through the prime, so you can say S prime. Okay, so we have a, did I call it anything? We have a Lagrangian now, LP, which is LQ, Q prime divided by T prime times T prime. We have two independent variables, Q and T. As configurations. So we just go through the usual motion and trying to define momenta and define our Hamiltonian. So we would define PT as a derivative of this with respect to T prime. Okay. I have get one L because it's multiplied with C prime, then I get here that's it's a old Lagrangian with a entry Q dot, so that is a exterior the external whatever derivative with respect to this entry. And check if I can take derivatives. Sorry, it was a minus too fast.
It's
still
the T prime.
The T So with this minus sign, which comes from 1 over t prime derivative, this looks already like an Hamiltonian. And in fact, this, the, well, we will see that this is actually PQ. It's a usual moment, I mean, and the usual thing, it is the momentum conjugated to Q, and it will also turn out to be here. The momentum conjugated to Q. This is Q dot, Q prime divided by T prime. And this is minus L if you put a minus here. And so this is a usual little Hamiltonian, I mean, not little Hamiltonian, sorry. It's a usual Hamiltonian in Hamiltonian for L, for the non-parametrized system, not for LP. And PQ is DL P DQ prime. And so this would be DL DQ prime, DL DQ dot times 1 over T prime times T prime. So well, it's just the usual PQ. And write this is, write it out for the particle. You see that this is M times Q dot, but Q dot is Q prime divided by T prime. So to summarize, you have PT. So you see one nice thing. You see that the momentum conjugated to time is actually the Hamiltonian. Surprise. Indeed, the Hamiltonian is supposed to do your time evolution. and PQ is is given in terms of derivatives, and you have a quotient of derivatives. So what do you usually try to do?
Find the commutators.
Yeah, usually the canonical going to the Hamiltonian formalism means you try to replace the velocities with momenta. So the next step here, you have defined the momenta in terms of your configurations and velocities. Usually you try to now express your velocities in terms of momenta. Because then you would take this formula and replace your velocities with the momentum. But can you actually invert your velocities for the momentum? No. So here you have something which only involves one momentum, and there's no velocity here. You get an equation which is a
constraint.
A constraint on phase space. Here, so this is a constraint, and here you get something. You get one momentum, but you get it as a quotient of velocity, so that's the most information you can get. You know, so you get only a map from your tangent space of your configuration, so with your velocities, which tells you all configurations where this quotient is equal mapped to the same space point. So this map is not one to one. The translation between phase space and I don't know, velocity space. And you see already, well, that this map is not one to one. It's not too surprising because having either the information on T prime or Q prime gives you, well, fixes, you know, what your S parameter does with respect to F. So this quotient is, of course, is invariant information here. Okay. So we have this constraint. Let it define. Let's call it P. It's PT plus H PQ Q. So let's ignore that we can't define the all the that we cannot invert T prime and Q prime separately. Let's nevertheless try to define the Hamiltonian for this parameterized system, which I will call capital H. And so this will be defined in the usual way as PT T prime plus PQ Q prime minus the Lagrangian, which is the old Lagrangian multiplied with T prime and with the right entries. So this Q prime is Q dot times T prime. So here I can write T prime. Here I have another T prime. So this is T prime PQ Q dot minus L, and this is my Hamiltonian for the original Lagrangian by definition. So I have T prime PT minus plus H PQ Q. So in this case, it didn't matter too much that we don't have we can't replace T prime. What we see is that we can still write the Hamiltonian, and if we define it in the usual way, as a multiple of T prime. But what is this? That's our constraint. And so as I promised you some time ago, if you have a diffeomorphism invariance, or here reparametrization invariance, your Hamiltonian is equivalent, is proportional to a constraint. So here we have just one constraint, so we have just one constraint. So now you can also see that T prime, which in fact is exactly the translation between time and our evolution parameter, that's a multiple of our usual time generator, either for PT or for HPQT. And so this is actually what is equivalent to in GR to the so-called lapse function, which also tells you how fast time is flowing. So that's, in fact, if you write the time evolution equation, G prime would be, so I call it, let's call T then N for lapse, NC T, so in C, so N is just a free parameter in this case, like our gauge parameters before. C only depends on P, there's only this PT, so we just get N. So the lapse is just this change, and you can also Q dot Q prime is Q and C. And so you have N, and then you have DH PQQ. PQ. Not with minus sign. So this gives you the usual equation of motion for Q dot, Q prime and Q dot. So you also find that Q dot is equal to N times Q dot. And N is T prime, so it's the same equation as here. And so you can also write it for P prime and so on. So you just have introduced N here as an arbitrary parameter, and N is just the translation. Our time T and our evolution parameter. Okay, but now we basically have indeed time evolution as a time meaning here with respect to S is a gauge transformation. And we said we need physical observables. And so we said these need to satisfy that a physical observable F, capital F, commutes with the constraints weakly. Okay, so let's try to find physical observables in this case. And so there's a general idea in particular in these systems where you have time evolution as a gauge transformation that use relational observables. So basically our parameter, evolution parameter S is now, we can basically freely choose parameterization, reparameterization of S, which will change the trajectory. But already here we have seen that Q of T itself is a, it's an invariant formulation. So what you have actually added in some sense is a need or is an explicit clock function. And so what you want to ask is always, where is Q in relation to where T is? So you, it's a system where you introduce T as a, the reading of T as an explicitly. So how do we make? So we can construct a general observable. Families of observables which are associated to any phase space function F. Tau is a parameter. And that's the value of little f for the evolution parameter S, where G of S is equal to tau. So actually, you know, you have a gauge orbit here. You ask what is f of p here? F of tau at this point p here. Then you need to find the point on your gauge orbit where t of s is equal to tau. And so f of tau is defined to be little f of p prime. And so you can go to another point p, but then you would again ask, where is my point on the gauge orbit where t of s is equal to tau? That will be here. So you will get the same value for your observable for all the points along the orbit. As long as there's only one point on your gauge orbit where this condition is satisfied. So that's quite similar to gauge fixing. And in fact, this is, can be also called gauge invariant extension of gauge fixed functions. Okay, so what would be Q when T of S is equal to tau? So to, you can read the script and apply the formula, but in principle, it's also a question here, if you notice, because I'm asking questions about the dynamics now. So here you need to solve for the dynamics of the system, because I need to, this will be, you know, compui tau can be a point in the future. If my t is now one and I ask what is my q if tau is five, so I need to know, solve my trajectory to see where that is. And so if you take the free particle, well, that I can solve the trajectories. And solve the dynamics, that's the initial value of Q. So via phase space, these are initial values, Q plus state line, PQM. So now I need to evolve for the time it takes. Well, I need to evolve for a time. And this time is given by the time you are at the moment, t, which is now a phase space variable, it's part of your initial values, and the time you want to go to, tau. And so as an exercise, you can indeed compute the Poisson bracket of this with constraint. What is Fp of tau? Anyone? What is the momentum of a free particle?
So
this is PQ. And indeed, PQ, you can also sit down and compute it, but you see PQ, if you put a free particle there, H will not depend, little h will not depend on P, on Q, sorry. So that will commute with your constraint. And so you can actually also compute hey, what is f of t of tau? What is t if t is tau? It's tau, and you can also compute fpt of tau. But again, that will be minus. There's a constraint which is preserved, and the constraint is plus, so that will be minus hpq. It only depends on the free particle for q, but this will be in general true, also if you don't have the free particle. So you can use this kind of computing capital F relational observables associated to any phase space function f for all the variables you have. And this will, in general, this gives you complete information on your physical observables. And so here we get something interesting. Here we get something interesting. But this is just a constant, so that doesn't give you something interesting. And this, in our case, is just a function of PQ. So it does not give you anything in addition to that. So the kind of independent observables here is just given by these two. And well, two is, as before, we had a two-dimensional phase space at the very beginning. And so that's quite consistent. OK, well, next week, if the situation allows, we will just finish to discuss the time evolution here. We are almost finished with the time evolution, and then we can just quantize the system in various ways to see what you have to do, to learn what you have to do to quantize a gauge system. OK, thank you.